AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205. Minnesota 1918, when flu, fire, and war ravaged the state. Kurt Brown is the author. You might recognize Kurt as a long-writing history writer for the Star Tribune. His book is out right now. He's kind enough to join us to talk about his book. Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I'm doing great, Matt. Thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for being here, and I think your articles in the Star Tribune are exceptional. I really like the one about the Hopkins Raspberry Festival that you did around the 4th of July.
Well, it's really become, we've done it now for 5 years, and it's become kind of a crowdsourcing history thing. The first column we wrote, we put a little, almost as an afterthought at the end, we said, if you have suggestions or ideas for this column, email minnesotahistory@startribune.com, and it comes into my Gmail, and I tell my wife that every week I kind of put my hands out, and these little gifts kind of parachute down with people's family stories, and so I'm the lucky guy who gets to spin these tales, but it's really a reader-driven, character-driven project, and I love it.
I'll tell you about my great-uncle Cedric Adams' wedding up in 1929 up in the Iron Range, all right?
Well, that would be great.
I'd love to tell you about that. The 1918, your book, I'm glad we bring up this year because I am really starting to realize that via the Minnesota Historical Society with their World War I exhibit they had, plus reading a little bit on my own, I think 1918 was such an important pivotal year world internationally in the U.S. and in Minnesota. It's a year I think that a lot of people kind of overlook because of World War II. But the reality is this really changed a lot of things going on in the state of Minnesota.
Well, and for me, I was commissioned by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. They wanted to kind of commemorate the 100th anniversary of this year. It was really a trifecta of woe. Not only did you have World War I raging in Europe and taking tens of thousands of Minnesotans into the trenches, but you had the flu pandemic, the deadliest outbreak of a disease in world history. And on top of all that, in October of 1918, you had deadly fires up in the Cloquet Moose Lake area that I think a lot of people don't realize was the number one natural disaster in terms of a death toll of over 450 people dying from the fire. And if you were lucky enough to survive the fire, you were often crammed into evacuee housing where you got the flu and died. So it was truly a trifecta of woe, Matt.
You break the book down. It's interesting. Each one of your chapters kind of has a theme, which is not necessarily specifically the war or the flu or the fires. You run basically through the year.
Well, and originally I thought I was going to look for two or three characters that maybe were touched by two or three of these things, the flu, the war, and the fires. And I kind of shifted during the research, because I was getting all kinds of great stuff, county historical societies, and I kind of put the word out to the network of history buffs in Minnesota. And so I kind of changed to a more of a mosaic approach, where I just took a lot of individual stories that I thought were compelling and kind of stitched those together. So instead of wrapping the narrative around two or three people, I decided to just kind of give a mosaic, and hopefully at the end of the book, readers get a sense of what that year was like in Minnesota.
We'll talk about each one of these kind of individually because they are, on their own, they were such large issues. And World War I is where we'll start off. The United States doesn't enter into the war till late. But at the same time, this was an interesting war. The Spanish-American War, there were the Spanish territories, that were, nearby. So there was kind of that feeling of justification, even though it ended up being on a global scale. The Zimmerman Met letter sends the United States on in. Talk a little bit about that, because I mean, when you look at the idea of this, I mean, sending the a lot of these people, their families had just come to the United States within the last 40, 50 years, and now they're going back and fighting a war in Europe.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in Minnesota and around the country think, oh, Minnesota, that's where all the Scandinavians live. But actually, German ancestry is the dominant strain in Minnesota. So at that time in 1918, there were so many kind of newly arrived German immigrants, and all of a sudden we're in a war, a world war, which we'd never been in a foreign war like that before. And so a lot of these kids who were being sent over to the trenches were going to fight the kids of their parents' old neighbors from Westphalia and other parts of Germany. So with New Ulm and places in Minnesota so deeply rooted in German tradition, it was really a quandary for the state.
Well, and I was reading a little bit and watching a little bit about World War One. One of the things I found to be fascinating was really up until even 1916, the Germans were coming on like, you know, goodwill tours to get money and donations and praise. They were coming into the United States and being greeted by the German ancestors that were here as heroes, that it wasn't really until later that the decision was made. But still, it was not an easy choice for the German Americans that were here, because this was the feeling of, and granted, I mean, Europe every once in a while, every 20, 30 years was blowing up into a war, you know, and so there is still, you know, there's long simmering feuds that were there. All of a sudden you're fighting under a completely different flag against your own country. That was not something that I think that went over too well at all.
No, and then in towns like I mentioned, New Ulm, which was deeply, of course, there's Hermann the German, a big statue in New Ulm in southern Minnesota. So the mayor and the leaders of the community were all very strong and had recently visited German. Some of the doctors had been over there and studying with German scientists. And so there was all kinds of connections. So all of a sudden you were asked, are you a patriot to America? And of course, they have a love and an oath for their new country, but they still have relatives and family and history in Germany. So, like I said, it was quite a dilemma for a lot of these people. And it became kind of an anti-immigrant. You know, a lot of the themes in my book you see playing out today as well, mm-hmm. with flu deaths, you know, high, and soldiers fighting in far-off wars, and forest fires are worse than ever. But that whole anti-immigrant sentiment now that is kind of ripping the country apart was certainly at play, although it 1918, it was the German, and the Germans were being considered the disloyal, and maybe they were spies for the enemy, and so there was a lot of paranoia in that department.
Well, and exactly, you say the mimicking of the modern times, the battle lines had been drawn, us versus them. And I think by the time we got to the end of 1918 and the end of World War One, America itself had changed in that it was no longer, once you come here, you're under the red, white, and blue. And there was still some carryover into World War II, a little bit of that. But for the most part, I think there was this idea of, you know, we are our own country, we're our own identity. But it was the growing pains and that war that basically finally pushed the United States into that. We're no longer a bunch of immigrants. We are our own country. And I think Teddy Roosevelt earlier, like I said, the Spanish-American War, was able to kind of solidify it to a point. But I really feel as if when we got to the end of World War One, that's really what the mantle of America became.
Yeah, I've heard the metaphor before. A lot of people have heard about the melting pot. And we mm-hmm. became this, you know, a bunch of different ethnic backgrounds have come together and melted together as one, when really, I think in some ways it's more of a salad where you have a bunch of stuff in the same bowl, but it all some's crunchy and some is different. Maybe I'm torturing the analogy, but somewhere between the melting bowl and the salad bowl, we found ourselves in 1918.
I like your analogy. Good salad, soup and salad. There's nothing wrong with that. The flu obviously was another problem. I've read actually about Philadelphia's issues they had with the flu. I read a great book about 20 years ago about that, and I never knew the flu was this bad. It's same thing. You know, soldiers, primarily soldiers coming back from World War One, bringing with them a European strain, this flu, which in Philadelphia at the time wiped out a large portion of their population. This was really an incredible disease issue that we just kind of have forgotten about.
And really, without World War One, we don't have this big pandemic, because the misnomer is, a lot of people call it the Spanish flu, and that's rooted in the fact that the U.S. and British governments both had kind of censorship laws going on, and you weren't allowed in the media to report on anything that might hurt the war effort. So you see a lot of the old newspaper clips I found in my research. The county health directors or medical leaders would say, well, there's a flu and a couple people have died, but we'll have this thing under control. Don't worry about it. They kind of course, downplayed it, not to hurt the war spirit. Spain was not really involved in World War One, so when tens of thousands of Spaniards started dying, all of a sudden it became known as the Spanish flu. But the flu really started in Kansas, they think. There's a lot of different theories, but the leading theory is it was a farm kid in Kansas who probably contracted this deadly strain of influenza from a pig. Then he went off to trained for World War One in a crowded camp where suddenly dozens of his fellow soldiers got the flu. And as these troops were moved all around the place and transported to Europe and back and all around, that flu spread, and 50 million people, they estimate worldwide, ended up dying of the flu.
Well, and your book touches on some of the numbers here. The 196,000 U.S. citizens died from the flu in October while fires were going on, as you mentioned earlier as well. And then you basically, of the 1.8 billion people on the planet in 1918, nearly one-fourth of its population, estimated 7.5 billion. According to the Science Journal, about one in five people globally came down with the flu in 1918. 28% of Americans. Do you know the number? How many Minnesotans died in Minnesota from the flu?
Well, the best estimate is about 12,000. And if you think about that, today the state is three times bigger than it was in 1918. So I mean, it would be just a huge number of people dying in a matter of months. Really, like I said, like you mentioned, October was kind of the peak for all these things: the fires in northern Minnesota, the flu. Came in about three different waves, and I don't know if a lot of people realize, but more soldiers died of the flu than in the battlefields. Minnesotans sent 118,000 people into World War One, and 1,400 died on the battlefields, killed in action, but almost twice as many, 2,300, died of the flu. So you find that a lot of times, even back in the Civil War, disease is often the number one killer, more than the bullets and the tanks and the cannonballs.
And what was it's interesting, as a person who is a veteran, I'm a veteran, I was U.S. Army, they still teach those lessons they learned from World War One today, whereas in the Civil War, they kind of shrugged their shoulders. But as when we got into the 1880s, 1890s, and they realized hygiene was a big issue of it, I mean, there's a reason why they tell you today that if you're in a war zone, you shower, you shave, you clean yourself up whenever you can, because they learned there are some lessons, and that, like I said, the impacts of this were great. And when you think about Minnesota, you know, people are off fighting in Europe, people are dying around you. It must have been surreal for the people back here to see something that was more reminiscent almost of the Black Death going on in town.
Yeah, one of the haunting stories in my book involved the Soderberg family, which is a large Swedish family up in the Moose Lake area. And they were all worried about David Soderberg, who was fighting with mustard gas in the trenches and the mud. And if you think about, I mean, all wars are kind of horrible. As a veteran, you could certainly relate to that. The Civil War was certainly no picnic. But I think when World War One, you introduce aircrafts dropping bombs, mustard gas, and horrible trench warfare. Anyway, this family's all worried about David off in Europe, and now the fires come sweeping across northeastern Minnesota. The parents put, I think it was 11 kids, in their root cellar out where they would keep their, you know, food stored for the winter, their ham and their potatoes, and figured they'd be safe there. As the fire came over, they threw buckets of water on the door to try to keep everybody safe, and then they hollered down the little ventilation tube to see if everybody was okay, and got no response. And after the fires burned through, they opened the door and found 11 people had suffocated as those fires sucked the oxygen right out. So a lot of people were worried about the horrors going on in Europe, but the horrors in Minnesota were arguably worse. When David Soderberg returned, his whole family had been wiped out.
I mean, I've heard from people about the fire specifically. We can turn our attention to that now. It was surreal in the sense they just left bombed out buildings, bombed out towns, destruction in Europe, and came back to basically the same thing in areas of Minnesota. Why were the fires so bad that year?
Well, it was the driest year that Minnesota had experienced, the driest summer in 48 years. And the railroads played a fascinating chapter in the whole tragedy. And at the end, the government had taken over all the railroads because we were in wartime, so they'd kind of nationalized the railroads. And at the end of this saga, they looked back and investigated what caused the fire, and it was sparks from railroad trains that ignited that dry, brittle summer up in northeastern Minnesota. I mean, the trains were also heroic and saved thousands of lives with rescue trains pulling into towns and saving people, but they were ultimately pointed as the cause of the fire, and it was the first time ever that regular people took on the government and the railroads and sued and won. And it took 35 years until it all was made whole, and the people of Minnesota were given the money they got for losing farms and lives and livestock.
Well, basically making sure the people who really were culpable were out of the way before they got the ruling, the justice on this. How many fires, I mean, specific fires were identified in 1918?
Well, it was a bunch of little fires that kind of turn into a big major fire. And if you go to Moose Lake, of course, they'll call it the Moose Lake Fire. If you go to Cloquet, they'll call it the Cloquet Fire. And they're very kind of, you know, they kind of localize things. But it really just turned into one big fire. And it could have been a lot worse. It got all the way to Duluth, to the fringes of Duluth, which, of course, was a thriving major kind of at its peak town in those days. And it made it all the way down to Lake Superior. But really, the typography in Duluth, with the way the hills kind of wrap around Lake Superior, kind of stopped the fire from being even worse.
One of the things that's interesting is you talk about the people and they're driving cars into lakes to basically, you know, save them. This idea of a wall of fire, that you saw a forest and where there was a forest is now just a wall of fire coming for you. There, a lot of these people that ended up dying in this catastrophe, there just was nowhere for them to go. And even in some cases in the lakes, that was just, if it was, you know, it wasn't a big enough lake, you got killed that way because of oxygen getting sucked out or just it got too hot.
Yeah, and there's stories of survivors who would, like you say, gather in places like Moose Lake and throw wet blankets on each other to try to save each other. And witnesses saw the flames even jump across the lake and hit across the other side. So, you know, we get a few survivor stories, and I thought it was fascinating. A lot of the people affected by this fire, of course, were newly arrived immigrants from Scandinavia, and a lot of Finns up in that area were fighting the fires and, you know, doing the best they could.
I would say this, the one thing that comes after this is that we don't seem to have the fire issue that we had before after this time. Obviously, I think the legal attention, the spotlight being shown on the railroads and stuff, I think that obviously pushed them to kind of address their issues at that point. But I think we, as well, that there came an idea that if we don't start dealing with these fires and knocking these down quickly, that we're going to end up losing major towns again.
Yeah, and I think that certainly the fire technology isn't what it was today. You know, that there were basically, you know, volunteers with buckets trying to put out this raging fire, and we've come a long way. But at the same time, out west, we've seen horrible fires the last few years in California sweeping through the west as well. You know, the railroads, they had some laws in place where they were supposed to put screens over the smokestacks to stop the cinders and sparks from coming out. But a lot of the conductors didn't like to use those because that would slow down your train and you couldn't be as efficient in getting stuff hauled around. And Minnesota at the time, too, it's worth pointing out, was really in a transition from a timber. They pretty much wiped out a lot of the timber up north. So we had gone from kind of a lumberjack economy up in that northeastern Minnesota and shifted it more towards mining and farming. So we were kind of at the end of the log boom that dominated kind of the early years, the 1880s and that kind of year. So by 1918, they'd kind of run through a lot of the timber, and and after these fires, they kind of shifted to more of a farm economy up there.
Well, and I can say this because my family was from the Iron Range. That changed the vegetation. I mean, you had these tall pines that were all taken down, and I've heard from people who said that, you know, once you changed that and you had, you know, more coniferous trees and they changed, you had much more ground. Like I said, you never used to have deer up there, but all of a sudden deer were everywhere because you changed the environment by cutting down all the trees, and that actually was a catalyst as well for these fires.
Yeah, and I mean, the amount of stories, for me, the real challenge was kind of being a gatekeeper and what gets in and what gets out. And I mentioned the Finns before, and a lot of the stories were passed down. There was a Finnish guy named Edwin Manny who was a Finnish banker up there, so the Finns trusted him with their money and their stories. And in the 60s and 70s, he went around and recorded all these survivor stories and typed them up in kind of a hard-to-find book, and luckily I got a copy of it, that that, and some of these he would meet people that he knew very well, but he said it wasn't until they would retire to the saunas that they would, you know, they didn't like talking about this stuff, but he got a lot of his information, a lot of these stories were passed down in the Finnish saunas of northeastern Minnesota.
Well, you and I could talk for an hour, easy. And by the way, I'm going to give you an open invite. I've given this open invite to about three or four people. Anytime you want to come on my show, I'll make time for you, because this book is fascinating, and it's always a treat to talk to someone who knows history and can enlighten us on the changes. The book is, I got a few things I'm going to mention here with you, because you got a few appearances you're going to make here. Minnesota, 1918, when flu, fire, and war ravaged the state, Kurt Brown, he's going to be, first of all, over at the Twin Cities Bungalow Club, St. Mary's Episcopal Church. This is going to be on August 22nd at 5 p.m. on Laurel Avenue in St. Paul, $5 for non-members. You have two events going on in Austin on Friday, August 23rd, a workshop at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. a visit to Sweet Reed's Bookstore. And then that's going to be on Saturday, August 24th. So you're obviously going to be going out there. I'll make sure I get all those events posted out there. And I'm presuming the book is available everywhere, right?
Yeah, they just decided to put out a paperback edition of the book. So if people haven't read it, and I should point out, it sounds like such a downer of a book, you know, the flu, the war, but it's really a story of resiliency and survivors. And there's a lot of uplifting stories about how people got through it and how they patched their lives back together and moved forward, which is kind of a classic Minnesota spirit. Comes through, I think. So it's not as depressing as it may sound.
Well, and it should be mentioned, change does not happen without tragedy. And we have to sometimes go into really bad cases to finally realize we need to make changes. And I think that 1918, that's why it was such a pivotal year. It was a bad year, but at the end of it, what came out of that was good.
Exactly. And people rallied together. And like I said, the resiliency of Minnesota has shown like never before.
Find Kurt's articles in the Star Tribune. I believe there's one on Sundays, right?
They're always on page B4 because history happened before. So that's right. And we've had 253 weeks, but who's counting consecutive weeks with a Minnesota history column? And like I said, I love doing it every week. So you can find those in the Star Tribune, and you can come see me when I'm giving these events
once again
week.
Twin Cities Bungalow Club, 7 p.m. St. Mary's Episcopal Church. That's on August 22nd. Once again, I'll make sure I get a link to that. It's $5 for non-members of the Twin Cities Bungalow Club to join that. But by all means, as you've heard here, Kurt Brown, I highly, highly recommend the book, Minnesota 1918. Kurt, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Matt. I look forward to speaking with you again down the road.
Anytime, my friend, anytime. We'll take a break. Come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.